No, we won't take it, said a voice out loud. No, we won't take it, we will stand our ground. No.
Good morning and welcome to the Sarah Schulz Show, where we the people are now in session. We have a great show coming up for you today. In the first hour, we have Doug Cunningham from Workers Independent News and the People's Mic. He'll be on to discuss labor issues. We'll have Don Lindoff-Shigoni from Call for Peace. And she'll end our first hour. In the second hour, I will have... We'll actually start it off with Don Lindoff-Shigoni, followed by a recorded interview I have of Kate Coyne McCoy, the Executive Director of CAPS, and we'll end the show with Scott Witkoff from Badger Democracy. Now, the phone number to call in is 310-742-1896, and my toll-free number is 877-497-1797. We'll also have a live discussion online at blogtalkradio.com. You can post your comments or questions there, and we'll try to get them on the air for you. Now, we're going to go to Yuri in just a moment. Before I get there, I just want to let you know this will be my last show of the year. Not forever, just for the year. So I'll be off the next 2 weeks. You'll still be able to hear me on my best of shows on Citywide LP 99.1 in Madison. And I will be back on January 6th. So don't worry. If you don't hear me, it's not that I'm going away. It's just I'm just taking a couple weeks off and definitely be back. So... But I'd like to get to Yuri Raskin right now with Defend Wisconsin Weekly News Roundup. Good morning, Yuri. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Sarah. How are you doing?
I am doing good. It's not raining out. It's not overcast. It's not foggy. It's actually sunny. I haven't been outside, so maybe it's, I don't know how cold it is, but it looks nice, and that works for me.
Exactly. As long as the weather looks outside my window just fine, that's great. That's great. So I wanted to start by wishing every listener out there happy holidays, whatever you may be celebrating. Have a wonderful holiday season. I hope you are having one, Sarah. Are your holidays going well?
Yeah, you know, they are, with all things considered. They are. I have, it's the first Christmas for both my niece and my nephew, which was exciting. So one's going to be about one, and one's about 1 month, so... Neither one will remember it, but it's always fun to have two additions to the family, so that's always a nice...
Well, that's what all the cameras are for, so you can take lots of pictures. And that's what we got. We have lots of pictures that we will remember this wonderful holiday season by, that we can remember this whole year by. What an incredible year this has been. We got protesters as the person of the year, according to Time Magazine, and really every citizen in Wisconsin gets their part of that award. So you are Person of the Year, Sarah. Congratulations.
Well, and so are you, Yuri. Congratulations as well. Now, I heard that they I heard that they didn't mention Wisconsin. Is that true? I haven't read it, so I don't know.
Well, I'm relying on all sorts of secondhand information, because to go out and actually buy Time Magazine would be just almost not protester-like. However, there's some great, it says when hundreds of thousands of working middle-class protesters occupied Madison to protest anti-worker legislation, they helped ignite a spark across the country. It started in Madison. This is from Time Magazine, so it looks like we were reflected. So that is a good thing.
That is, and I was going to say, a lot of times... when you see things about protests, you'll always see a thank you to Wisconsin or a mention of Wisconsin. It's not just in America. It's all over the world. There's always something that says, this is our Madison, Wisconsin, which is always it makes me feel kind of nice to know that we help bring things forward, help move things forward, and we had a huge hand in helping change the world.
Absolutely. You know, I always felt that Wisconsin was in the middle of everywhere and center of the universe. And here we are, just clearly between us and Egypt. That's the center of the universe. And we have some actual news to do this week to report, which is really awesome, because it's nice to be recognized for all the wonderful things that happened this year. But there's even more exciting stuff that's going to happen. Yesterday was announced that 507,000 signatures were already collected, and that's pretty much with a month left to go in the recall effort during the deadline to collect the signatures. And the new goal is, of course, 720,000, which is nearly 200,000 more then is needed. So we're going to see where that all goes, but I think we can be rest assured that we're going to have the signatures to recall Scott Walker. And tomorrow is supposed to be a big day. We're getting all the volunteers out throughout the state, kind of a total recall day to get as many signatures as possible. And at the same time, there's some protests that are being, I can't say organized, because I suppose there's, if you have four or more people, you need to let somebody know. But there's a word out on the internet that there might be some people out near Capitol tomorrow and Monday for Solidarity Sing-Along. So if you're in Madison, you may want to, you know, drive by and check it out and maybe even tell your friends, because that's always a good time. You know, that's a great place to make new friends, meet new people, and make a statement about Governor Walker and what our state is going through.
And I also heard that the ACLU will have watchers out there. I believe it's the ACLU has the law watchers. Isn't it them that does that?
Entirely possible. We are looking at a situation that's unprecedented, and ACLU has been really playing a more and more important part in providing legal assistance, because there are lawsuits that are being, you know, these rules are being challenged, and thank goodness for ACLU being out there. At the same time, our governor for the next few days and GOP are suing State Elections and Ethics Agency over recall effort, which is just really, you know, on one level it's maddening, on the other level it's just hilarious, because I think the governor has a purpose of being disliked by everyone by the time he's finally recalled. But they filed a lawsuit in Waukesha County Circuit Court, because now you can sue the government outside of Dane County, which kind of wasn't a very friendly environment, I suppose, for conservative Republicans. So guess where they go? They go to Waukesha County Circuit Court, and they sue the Government Accountability Board, which they voted for, because when it was passed just a few years ago, it passed nearly unanimously. And now we have Fitzgeralds opposing it and saying, well, maybe we need to go back to the way things were, because, you know, whatever we have now is just not helping us. You know, you got to love the fact that they're fighting and they're clawing at any way possible to stay in power. And it just looks so bad, because nobody really is. You know, this is not popular governor when he has to go to courts and fight over every signature and claim that people saying that allowing multiple signatures is a violation of the equal protection clauses of the state and U.S. Constitution. Yeah, that's just an insult to democracy, frankly.
Well, the interesting thing is the GAB was formed, the Government Accountability Board was formed, because the conservatives complained that it wasn't bipartisan, or it wasn't nonpartisan with Doyle. So then they changed it to this, and now they're saying, well, it's not really, this isn't any nonpartisan either, so we got to go back to the way it was.
Right, and ultimately this is just something that really bothers me about the political situation in the state is that you have people who are setting up rules until the rules no longer work for them, and then they want to change the rules. That's not right.
Well, and Jeff Fitzgerald has put in a bill, and I'm afraid it might pass, that says that if you sign the petition more than once, that you could be fined up to $10,000 and spend up to 3.5 years in prison, which I find very interesting, because it's kind of redundant. There's always things in place that will actually stop all of that. If people accidentally sign again, or if a false name is signed, or if something is wrong, the thing already set in place will take care of that. So it's really not necessary.
You're correct on several levels, because first of all, recall process has multiple checks and balances already in place. It's designed with multiple checks and balances provided by the nonpartisan GAB, as well as competing partisan interests of the recall committee and the incumbent office holder. But we're going to have people who sign multiple petitions be charged, and with crimes now, you know, you and I, I'm sure, have seen people who oppose the recall effort, claim to have signed multiple petitions just to screw up the numbers. Well, hello, so I guess these people are going to be the ones getting charged.
You know, that's what I thought, too, because if you're getting people who have signed a false name, they're trying to screw up the system. So they're, in a way, they're kind of hurting themselves. So I find that very interesting. But how do you think the efforts that he's doing will affect his run for U.S. Senate?
Well, the one thing that's for certain is that he wants to come across as the most conservative Republican in the race, which means the Assembly is going to take up every conservative bill they can possibly come up with between now and the primary, which means that the one thing that they're not going to care about is jobs, which, of course, Wisconsin is leading the nation in losing because in the month of November, state lost 11,700 private sector jobs, which is a fifth consecutive month that the nation has been adding private sector jobs while Wisconsin has been losing. I guess if you want to run for Senate on your strong record as a conservative, you probably don't want to talk about jobs, and you want to talk about every possible conservative issues, like trying to make abortions harder. Like, it isn't a hard decision right now, but apparently the state wants to get further involved in it.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It is. There's another statistic here that October state coincidence index is 3-month change. And this is something that was posted out there. It's a great graph because it shows all the states and how their economy is growing or shrinking or whatever. And Wisconsin is a bright, glowing red because our economy is shrinking by 0 to 1% over the last 3 months, which is the worst of any state. We got to get this governor out of there. This is not just rhetoric. The numbers are pointing that he's been bad for Wisconsin. So I think that's pretty clear. The numbers are showing it. Another piece of news out there is we have a Wisconsin man who's charged with multiple felonies for defacing recall Walker petitions. That's really encouraging. As you and I talked about before, when people get persecuted for these crimes, we're going to see just end to it, which is really good. And Scott Fitzgerald recall. It's moving forward, which is really great news because volunteers in Beaver Dam area have gathered more than 5,500 signatures. And they need to get 16,742, and I guess now they're saying they have 9,200 at last count. So they're getting there, and this is such pure grassroots effort. You've got to love it. This is just people out there collecting signatures, and we have people from Rock County who are driving up there, and this is really right in the middle of the state. So, you know, you never know what could happen when people put their mind to it.
And it's really good to see. It's really good to see that someone is able to pull the papers and that it's really got a lot of legs and it's really going because they're right around halfway point, I believe, because I think she filed a couple days after. And they're halfway to the signatures, too. So I think that's great news. And, boy, would it be great to see him in a recall election. I think if you can get the signatures, I think he can be beat.
Well, it's certainly going to take his mind off of ruining the state in other ways, which would be great.
Yeah, like that crap mining bill that they have out there right now.
Exactly. In the meantime, Wisconsin has lost out on $1.3 billion in federal money. Of course, $800 million of it comes from the high-speed rail system that was supposed to be connecting Milwaukee, Madison, Chicago, and the Twin Cities. But additionally, there is $480 million that we lost from medical assistance, $13.2 million for job training for people with disabilities, $8.3 million for enforcing child support orders, and $4.2 million for administering food share and medical assistance programs. This is money that would be directly spent in Wisconsin economy. You have jobs, you have groceries that would have been purchased. So, I mean, this is just such direct, as usually federal assistance to people is, it's very direct help to our economy. And we lost $1.3 billion. So it's no wonder that our economy is not doing well, frankly, because that's a lot of money. Governor, of course, at the same time, continues to just say whatever comes to his head in order to make his numbers sound better. like saying that under our 2011/13 budget, the average Wisconsin property taxpayer will save $700. Well, the PolitiFact finds it false, because after providing a long explanation of why and where he could have found those strange numbers, they're saying in reality, typical homeowner would see $55 increase in 2 years compared with 2010.
Well, and, you know, I'm hearing that some people, someone had said that their tax bill went down 0.7 of 1%, and someone else said their tax bill went up $150.
Well, and it's the laws of averages. You know, when he makes these kind of strange claims of $700, and you have to dig deep in his papers to figure out where he could have come up with it, the averages are big numbers, and the averages are, in the end, are not in his favor at all. Just to catch up on a few other news, we have a first arrest made in the John Doe investigation, which is really exciting. We have Andrew P. Jensen, Jr., commercial real estate broker and a past president of the Commercial Association of Realtors of Wisconsin, arrested for basically not cooperating with the investigation. So, this, you know, it's good to know that things are moving forward, and while we the people are moving forward with the recall efforts, the justice system is also looking at Scott Walker for violations, and, you know, I guess maybe it's a race to see who will get him out of there first.
That's what I said. I said, we're fighting the FBI, and who's going to recall him first? So, is it going to be us to get the signatures and get the election, or is it going to be the FBI who's just going to remove him one day? He'll have a raid on the mansion, the governor's mansion, at 5 in the morning. Maybe he can get a cell next to Blagojevich.
You know, it really is just an indication of somebody that is so not good for their job that they are being investigated, recalled. It really is just kind of a part of the same package. The guy is just bad for Wisconsin. I guess to catch up on a couple of other pieces of news, we have a new poll that shows that Paul Ryan is quite vulnerable, and Rob Zirbon, who is running against him, is sounding really good to the voters. Paul Ryan is sounding worse and worse, and I think there's some real hope for the first congressional district, well, and frankly, for the entire nation, because Paul Ryan, you know, Newt Gingrich almost, his campaign almost pulled it right in the beginning, poor Newt, because he said that something bad about Paul Ryan, calling his budget reverse social engineering, and conservatives didn't like that. So seeing Paul Ryan on the ropes in the latest poll, I think it's very good news.
And that's really good news to end on, because, of course, he's my congressman, and it's nice to see that I actually might have a voice in my government at some point in time. So,
well, you have a voice already. Isn't that great?
It is. It's nice I can come out and say this, because no one else in my district is listening to me, as you know, any of my elected officials, and they have nothing to say. None of them hold open offices. That's great. They don't even have offices in my area. It's lovely. Anyway, thank you so much for being on, Yuri.
You're most welcome, Sarah. Happy holidays.
Yep, happy holidays to you, too, and I'll talk with you in the new year.
Sounds great. Bye-bye. Right.
Bye. That was Yuri Raskin with Defend Wisconsin Weekly News Roundup.
You're a mean one, Mr. Grinch. You really are a heel. You're as clumsy as a cactus. You're as slippery as an eel, Mr. Grinch. You're a bad banana with a greasy black heel.
I'd like to welcome Doug Cunningham to the Sarah Schultz Show. Doug is with Workers Independent News and the People's Mic. So thank you so much for being here today, Doug.
Well, thanks for having me, Sarah. I really was looking forward to this.
Well, I'm really excited you could be on. You are so big into labor and a lot of what the labor movement is doing. And with the recalls and everything going on, some of that's been kind of pushed to the side, and I want to bring it back, because it was the lack of respect that Walker had for the labor and the unions that started this all off, and it just kind of was the catalyst for everything.
Yeah, he really touched a nerve and crossed a line there, and I think he offended the values of people all over Wisconsin, whether they're in unions or not, you know, on that particular issue, because he stripped away that right when it was completely unnecessary to do that, to balance the budget in the first place. So, yeah, that's what got everything started. And I think had it not been that kind of explosive move by Walker, that we may not even be here in the recall effort, in the middle of the recall effort like we are.
I agree. I think that it was that, you know, I think what it did is it got people looking at what he was doing. I think if he hadn't touched the unions as he did and went after them as violent, as I don't want to say violently, but as much as he had, I don't think people would have started looking into some of the stuff that he's doing. And once they started looking into it, they started going, my goodness, what's going on here?
Yeah, it was a gigantic red flag that said to everybody, this is a different kind of governor. This is a more radical governor than we've ever had in Wisconsin. This is a governor who is willing to go against basic Wisconsin values to ram through an agenda that he has long wanted to achieve, he and other right-wing ideologues, and that's what this was about. And once people saw what the union issue got their attention, and of course everything that happened at the Capitol in February and March got the state's attention, and once riveted on the governor like they were, they began to see other signs, you know, that this guy was a totally different animal than anybody else that has ever been in the governor's office in this state. And I think that, that's really key to the power of this recall movement. It's not just about collective bargaining anymore. It's about a whole laundry list of things that the people of Wisconsin find offensive about this governor.
And there is. I mean, I could spend 2 hours just talking to different people, just talking about the stuff that he's done that people are just flabbergasted about when they hear about it. So
yeah, and you know, it's. And I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, please go ahead.
I was just going to say that the partisan nature of politics at this level, at the gubernatorial level, obviously it's an intense partisan atmosphere. But this transcends partisanism and partisanship. This whole movement to recall the governor is powered and fueled by his attack on collective bargaining for public workers. But, you know, once people started seeing and hearing from folks like, you know, Malin Mitchell, the firefighters, and police officers who were wearing their Cops for Labor shirts up at the Capitol, and teachers and nurses and other state employees and workers from all over the state, and, you know, from all sorts of different neighborhoods. I mean, people, it began to have a human face. I mean, people saw this incredible contrast between this governor who's doing the bidding of billionaires and has no respect for public employees and all of these fellow workers that everybody knows. I mean, they're our neighbors, our families, our friends, you know, and people really, really got that. I mean, they really understood that this was about much more than just a union issue. You know, it went to the core of what Wisconsin is and what it should be in the future and what we stand for as a state and what our values are. And that's very powerful stuff. I mean, that combination coming together is what has gotten us to this point and is what's going to carry us to even more history-making next year.
And Wisconsin's always been a labor state. Wisconsin has always, you know, it was the birth of the labor movement, basically. We were always one of the first states to enact some protections for labor. And bringing it back to labor, what are some of the main issues for labor in the current national and state political environment?
Well, there's a long list of issues that labor has on its agenda, because for decades now, and I've really been struck lately by the Census Bureau numbers on what's happening to working families in terms of median household income, poverty levels, things like that. And when you look at what's happening to our middle class and to our working families, from heavy unemployment to declining and stagnating wages to the loss of wealth in their 401ks and their pensions, you know, when you take a look at all of that erosion that has happened, you have to think about the labor movement, because it's been the labor movement that for decades now, ever since the North American Free Trade Agreement reared its ugly head back in the 90s, the labor movement has been saying, listen, our policies, our public policies on trade and taxes and other things, it's eroding the middle class. It's endangering the American dream. It's going to kill the American dream if we don't reverse these policies. Labor has been raising that red flag for years and years and years. And we're seeing, unfortunately, laborers' predictions coming true. The last 20 or 30 years, as a result of the policies that this country has pursued, and as a result of the relentless attacks on unions and undermining of unions, especially in the private sector, we have seen an erosion in the middle class. The middle class is actually shrinking in America now. Poverty is very, very high. We've seen poverty increase in the midst of this jobless recovery. And all of these things are coming together in this terrible, perfect storm that is very damaging to the very fabric of American society. When we lose our middle class, we begin to lose the bulwark of democracy, because whenever you have high income disparity and when you have a shrinking rather than growing middle class, you actually endanger democracy and freedom itself, because democracy thrives and depends on a strong middle class in this country. And unions, over the several decades or 100 years, actually, have been hard at work building up the middle class. And you look at the middle class erosion happening right alongside the falling membership of unions, the density, you know, the falling percentage in the private sector especially. And so all of these things are coming together, and unfortunately, you know, I wish the labor movement wasn't right about that, actually. I mean, I wish that our policies had actually led to a strengthening of the middle class and a strengthening of the American dream, but it hasn't. And so when people attack unions, when people like Walker attack public worker unions, they're attacking essentially the middle class, and they're taking money out of the pockets of the middle class, which is not only bad for those middle class workers and their families, but it's bad for our economy, it's bad for our state.
And how would you explain that to a non-union worker? Because the union workers get it. Anyone who's been in a union, my family has union family members, we understand what the unions have done. But if you're a non-union person, never had been involved with it, don't know the history of it, how would you explain that to them?
Well, you know, I would encourage them, and this is a hard sell sometimes, because economic statistics and facts and that sort of thing can be boring for people. I mean, you can just see people's eyes glaze over when you start talking numbers. But that's what I would urge people to do. If you're not in a union and you doubt that unions were instrumental in building the middle class and you doubt that they have been good for America, just spend an afternoon online, 2 or 3 hours even, online, and you can Google some of this information. You can go to the Bureau of Labor Statistics and find out, for example, that union workers still to this day earn significantly more money than non-union workers in America on average. Union workers in America have better health insurance from their employers, they have better pensions and retirement plans, and they have better benefits in terms of vacations, time off for sick days, things like that. And you can look also at places like the Economic Policy Institute or the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and you can go to their websites, which are pretty user-friendly, and you can quickly ascertain what's happened to middle-class families, working families, over the last 10, 20, 30 years. And once you get a picture of all that, then you look at the declining union density, and you can see that it's been pretty much tracked together in parallel. As union density falls, the percentage of workers that are in a union, as that falls, the middle class has been falling, and wages have been stagnating. And you begin to see a picture. A picture begins to emerge. Hey, look, unions do have something to do with building up the American class, whether I'm in a middle class, whether I'm in a union or not. You know, if I look at those statistics and those facts, I mean, those are facts. It's indisputable. And so you begin to understand that unions are good not just for their members and for the members' families. They're good for the entire economy because they put upward pressure on wages and benefits, whereas our trade policies and other things put downward pressure on it. And everybody knows when you're a working family, you know that it's not good for your family, you know, to make less money. You know it's not good for your family to have a lower quality health insurance plan that covers your family. You know it's not good for you when your retirement security is endangered, when you're depending on a 401k rather than a pension, defined pension, for example. So, you know, you can spend a little time thinking about this, but you must do that research. You've got to take a look at it so that it gets beyond the shouting at each other about here's my opinion and what's your opinion. And you know, opinion is one thing, but facts are another. And when you start to look at the facts, a clear picture begins to emerge that unions, in fact, are very good for working families in this country. And they've been very good for them for decades. And at the same time you see unions being weakened, you see the standard of living of middle-class Americans declining. And those two things correlate. And once you understand that, then you begin to get that picture that unions are good overall for the entire country.
Do Do you have any websites that people can go to for that stuff?
Well, I don't know the exact web address on top of my head, but for example, the Economic Policy Institute, or EPI, that has a lot of good information at that website. You can also go to the AFL-CIO national website. They have a blog there. They have other facts and information on the issues, and they pass that information along, so you can check that out. The Center on Economic and Policy Research, or CEPR, C-E-P-R, Google them online and go and check out some of the things that they're saying. And, you know, you got to understand, for one thing, when you talk about the economy in America, you're talking about 70% of the economy is driven by consumer spending. So demand is extremely important to sustain the economy, to keep the economy growing, and to create jobs. And what fuels demand? Well, it's the majority of Americans, the millions and millions and millions of middle-class people that spend their money in the economy. And so when you take money out of their pockets, it's just obvious that money is not going to be in circulation in the economy, and therefore demand will go down. And for all the talk about taxes and everything else, it's demand that really drives the economy, and it's demand that really creates jobs. And they can be sitting on piles of cash like they are now, the corporations and businesses, and they will not hire until they think demand is strong enough to sustain it. And so you can give them all the tax cuts in the world, and that's not going to create jobs. It's demand that creates jobs. So, you know, once you start putting these pieces of the puzzle together by going to websites like the Economic Policy Institute, the Center for Economic and Policy Research, the AFL-CIO's own website, Workers Independent News, Labor Radio, go there. And, you know, we have some archived stories from our past newscasts. We do a daily newscast on worker issues. Those are all good starting points, at least, to get a handle on this economic picture and to understand how unions relate to the overall economy and how unions impact what happens to all of us here in America who are working families.
All right, we're going to take a break right now. So I will be back with Doug Cunningham from Workers Independent News and the People's Might. You're listening to The Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. In a live webcast on Thursday, the Wisconsin Democratic Party said the people of Wisconsin have already collected nearly enough signatures to recall Governor Scott Walker, Democratic Party of Wisconsin Chair Mike Tate.
In just 30 days, in less than half the time granted, you have done something truly amazing. Your strength and determination has helped us collect more than 507,000 signatures to recall Scott Walker. And we are well on our way to beating our internal goal of collecting more than 720,000.
A total of 240,208 signatures are needed to recall Walker. United Wisconsin says its goal is to collect at least 720,277 signatures to make sure there are more than enough to trigger that recall election. Walker is targeted for recall for his attack on public worker collective bargaining, but a long list of other issues is also fueling this recall effort. Four Republican state senators are also targeted for recall. As recall activists near the number of signatures needed to recall Walker, potential legal trouble is also brewing for Wisconsin's unpopular governor. Andrew Jensen, a Milwaukee-area real estate broker and Walker campaign contributor, has been arrested as part of an FBI and grand jury probe of Walker aides. The FBI is investigating whether Walker aides illegally used Milwaukee County resources for partisan political purposes while Walker was Milwaukee County executive. In September, the FBI raided the home of longtime Walker aide Cynthia Archer. Nearly a dozen people have gotten immunity in return for testimony in the grand jury John Doe investigation. Some basic labor protections could be extended soon, Jesse Russell reports.
Home care workers could soon have the same minimum wage and overtime protections as most occupations. The Obama administration announced on Thursday that it planned to propose regulations that would put those workers, currently classified in the same category as babysitters, under the Fair Labor Standards Act. In a statement, the president said, "They work hard and play by the rules, and they should see that work and responsibility rewarded." For nearly 40 years, home care workers have been under the companionship label, which is exempt from the Fair Labor Standards Act.
Cooper Tire workers in Findlay, Ohio, have been locked out since November 28th. In 2008, the workers gave $31 million in pay and benefit concessions to help keep the company afloat. Now the tire company is turning a profit, and workers are hoping to recover some of those concessions. The company has announced it plans to open a new plant in Serbia next year. This newscast made possible in part through underwriting from the AFL-CIO. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary for Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Back speaking with Doug Cunningham from Workers Independent News, who you just heard just this last break, and the People's Mic. So before we go into some more of the labor issues on as general, I wanted to talk about the Manitowoc strike going on out there. Can you kind of, for people who haven't heard about it, because you really haven't heard about it down here, or, you know, you talked about it a lot in Madison, but we're not hearing it over in my section of down here in the southeast corner. Can you kind of talk about what led up to this strike?
Yeah, absolutely. Manitowoc Cranes in northern Wisconsin up there, there's a strike going on now. Approximately 200 members of the International Association of Machinists are on strike. Now, they were in negotiations with this company to settle a new labor contract, and it's been a union shop for many years. And they were making good progress on the issues, wages and other things, and they were close to having an agreement. They were close to being able to come together and decide that they're going to have a new labor contract that would cover these workers and everything was going to be fine. Well, at the last minute, the company, which is a supporter of Governor Scott Walker, by the way, they decided to drop this language into the bargaining table, into the negotiations, suddenly, at the last minute. And what they wanted to do is weaken the union by changing the rules that govern that particular employer and its union. And they wanted to basically take a page out of Governor Walker's playbook and his attack against public worker collective bargaining and do the same thing to that union up there as Walker has done to public employee unions across the state. And this is something that these workers could not accept. They were going to require, for example, annual recertification elections, so the membership would have to vote every single year about whether they wanted to keep the union or not. They were going to get rid of automatic dues checkoff, which means that the dues that are owed to the union by the members get automatically taken out of the paychecks and given over to the union. That's a common, normal practice in union shops. So these workers said, no, we don't want that. We want that language gone, and we will not agree to that. Well, the company refused to pull the language off of the table. And so these workers took a strike vote, and they voted, I think the vote was 180-2 or 180-3. It was a very, very powerful vote that they were against this language and would not agree to it. The company knew that, but insisted anyway that that language remain. And so it triggered a strike. And the workers now and their families have been on strike since the middle of November, and they are up there walking the picket lines, and their families are doing without their paychecks. They get $150 a week from their strike fund, and that's it. And, of course, the holidays are approaching, and, you know, it's a very easy thing to resolve. All the company has to do is say, okay, we back off. We're not going to be attacking your union rights. We're going to allow your union rights to remain intact as they've been for many, many years, and we'll just settle the other issues and get on with it, and we'll have that strike could be over tomorrow if they decided to do that. But they haven't. And last Saturday, there was a solidarity rally up there. It attracted about 3,000 people. And union members from all over the state came up. AFL-CIO President Phil Neuenfeld was there. Lots of other folks were there. And it was a solidarity rally to express the solidarity of Wisconsinites with these workers up there, because these 3,000 folks or so who showed up there, they understand that the same thing is happening now to these private sector workers that happened to the public workers in Wisconsin. Their basic union rights are being attacked. So that's what the strike is about. And that's why it's gotten some media attention, maybe not so much in your neck of the woods, but in other places, and in fact nationally, it's gotten some a little bit of play. And it's a very important struggle because it's one thing for a company to come to their workers and say, look, we're having a hard time financially. We need some flexibility. We need to talk to you guys about getting some concessions or cost breaks. That's one thing. But to actually attack the fundamental rights of workers to form unions, that weakens the union movement, that weakens the workers' voices on the job, and that's something these workers cannot accept. And so that's why they're out on strike. And that strike is likely to continue until the company does remove that language from the table.
Do you think the company will?
I don't know. It's going to be a very tough struggle because this company is, I think, cast in the same mold as Governor Walker to some degree. A company that respects its workforce and respects the union rights of its workforce would never have done that. So that tells me that they're pretty much hardcore right-wing and they're ideologues when it comes to union rights, and they're intent on smashing union rights. Because if they are successful at completely wiping out the labor movement in this country, then they can treat their workers in any way that they choose, and they can lower the wages, they can lower the benefits, they can change things at any time without workers having a single thing to say about it. And for Americans who love freedom, I mean, the best way for you to understand this, if you're listening to this and you're not in a union, if you love freedom as an American citizen, then you should love union rights, because that's nothing more than a democratic voice on the job for workers. And without that voice, you essentially turn over your entire work life to a dictatorial situation where you have absolutely no say, you're not considered an equal, you have no right to negotiate or bargain with anything, you just have to accept everything or walk away from the job. And that is something that should be against basic American values of freedom, because as a worker, you should expect to have the freedom to have a voice on the job and to have your voice taken into consideration in decisions, and to be treated, you know, as an American citizen who has some liberties and some rights. And that's what these workers are fighting for. They're not fighting for like an extra dollar an hour or for a better pension or for a better health care system or for more money. It's not a greed thing. These workers are defending their basic union rights. And by the way, a lot of non-union people would probably never understand this, but it is actually the official policy of the United States to encourage collective bargaining. That's in the National Labor Relations Act. And not all workers are covered by that act. Some workers are excluded from it, some public workers, for example. But that is the basic policy of the United States to encourage collective bargaining. Every time I say that to somebody, it's the official policy of the United States to encourage collective bargaining, they look at me like I'm crazy because they don't understand, because of the onslaught of anti-union attacks from companies over the years and from right-wing media over the years, the distortions that have happened. People don't understand. They don't get that that's the official policy of the United States. So, you know, I mean, it's just a basic American fundamental human right, as far as I'm concerned, the right to form a union. And that's what these workers up in Manitowoc Cranes are fighting for.
What the company did, is that kind of part of Walker's tools that he put out there for them to do?
Well, it's not. I mean, what it is it's a mirroring of what Walker did in the public sector here. I mean, that's basically it. I mean, the governor sends a signal. Just like the president of the United States establishes a signal and a tone, you know, if it emanated from the governor's mansion that he would respect labor rights, that he believes that workers ought to have the right to collectively bargain and that people should not attack those rights, then I think companies inside the state would be less likely to attack these things. But they saw that Walker was very rabidly anti-union and was willing to stoop very, very low in his efforts to destroy public worker collective bargaining, and that's a signal to everybody else in the state. And so, you know, that's a signal that at the time, I remember up in February and March at the rallies, some union members were saying, listen, we're private sector unions, but we're here supporting these public workers because we know that if this attack goes unanswered, that we're next in line to have our basic rights attacked. And that's exactly what appears to be happening at Manitowoc Cranes. And if Manitowoc Cranes gets away with it and successfully destroys the union rights there, then that will further encourage other companies to try and do the same thing in Wisconsin. And again, that's that downward spiral. You know, the more you attack unions and destroy them, the more you're attacking and eroding the middle class in America and the American dream.
What can we do to help them up there for people, union, non-union members, what can we do to help those out on the picket line?
The most important thing right now is material support. I mean, they need donations of cash. They need donations of food. Christmas is coming up and the holidays, you know, Hanukkah and everything else, so they need toys for their kids. Now, keep in mind, they're trying to survive. They're trying to keep their families alive on $150 a week right now. The company, obviously, is very wealthy. The CEO made like $4.9 million last year, I believe. So, you know, they're not suffering here. It's the workers out on the picket line that are suffering. So you can go to IAM516.org. That's IAM516.org. And when you go there, you can donate. And you can donate a small amount. I mean, I know everybody's struggling out here today, but if you've got $10, $20, $25 that you can give, that would be accepted, and that would be appreciated. If you've got a toy or some canned good foods or whatever that you want to donate, you can also do that. That kind of material support will allow them to sustain themselves and their families while they fight for this very important basic human right of union collective bargaining right. And that's the most important thing that listeners can do. So it's IAM516.org. Go there, do what you can to support these strikers.
Now, we have a couple minutes left, and I wanted to get you talking a little bit about WIN and the People's Mic. And the first thing I wanted to do is I wanted to say thank you for bringing that. You had a great show last Tuesday on the People's Mic about the Republican abuse and the violence towards the recall petitioners. And I just wanted to thank you for putting that out there, because people aren't talking about this type of stuff enough, especially with the petitioners. Some petitioners don't feel like they have anyone supporting them, and it was great that you were able to do that. So talk a few minutes about WIN and what its mission is, and then let people know about the People's Mic.
Sure. Workers Independent News, and by the way, our website is laborradio.org. You can go check us out. We're Madison-based, and we produce a daily newscast that goes out to a couple of hundred radio stations around the country, and we've been doing this for about 9 years. And this daily newscast is the only national daily newscast that focuses on work and family issues, the labor movement, and what the labor movement is doing and saying about the issues that face workers, and what workers themselves, rank-and-file workers, are saying about these issues. And so as what we try to do is cover the national movement of what workers are doing to fight back, to protect their union rights, to win better wages, better benefits for their families, et cetera, because that is the essence of the American dream. And we want to make sure that story is not untold. We want to tell that story every day. So we've been putting workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day for about 9 years, and I co-produced that with Jesse Russell. We've been doing that for several years, and we've been able to succeed and stay on the air, including in places in big markets. I mean, like New York City, 1010 Wins in New York. We were on there for 5 years, sponsored by some construction trade unions there in New York. And so we're a small organization. We have two full-time employees, Jesse Russell and I, and we're members of AFTRA, the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, the Chicago local. And we try and raise the money each year to sustain ourselves. It's been a struggle, but we've managed to do it, and we're going to continue doing it. And the People's Mic, we just launched about a month ago, and it is a talk show in Madison. And it's a daily talk show, 5 to 6 p.m. It's streamed live on the mic, 92.1 FM, 92.1.com, rather. And the reason that we decided to do the People's Mic, we had this opportunity come up to do the talk show and on the progressive talk station in Madison, and we thought, what a perfect time to do this. I mean, in the midst of this people's worker uprising in Wisconsin, this recall effort and everything else. And when we were up at the Capitol in February and March with those, you know, hundreds of thousands of other people over that two-month period, we saw every day up there all the protesters from all over Wisconsin and from other parts of the country come in to make a stand for this fundamental human right. And in the midst of these protests, there was often a microphone set up with a speaker, and it was called the People's Mic. And it allowed anybody who wanted to step up and have their say, to have their voice amplified and heard by their fellow citizens. And it was in the midst of the Capitol Rotunda, while the rotunda was being occupied by protesters, and it was outdoors as well, and it would come up whenever it arrived. So we wanted to call our show the People's Mic, because that's exactly what we want to do. We want to amplify the voices of the powerless many, and speak some truth to the powerful few, and we want to do it on the broadcast medium, and we want to take as much of that space on broadcast media as we possibly can and turn it over to the people and give them the microphone. And essentially that's what we're trying to do with this talk show. And we're off to a pretty good start, but it costs money to sustain it. And we're a small organization, and we don't have a huge budget. So, you know, it's going to be a struggle to keep ourselves on the air. But we're determined to give it our all to do that because we think it's important that media reflect what the real will of the people is and what's really happening to working people.
Well, thank you so much, Doug, for doing that, and thank you for being on today. We're going to have you on again. There are so many other things I didn't even get to yet. So you are just an amazing knowledge. You just have so much knowledge on labor, and it's so nice to talk to someone who just knows this stuff. And we'll definitely have to have you back on. But in the meantime, everyone can listen to him on the mic 92.1 in Madison or the mic 921.com. And you can hear him 5 to 6 every day. So thank you for being on, Doug. Have a happy holiday.
Thanks, Sarah. Same to you. And I look forward to maybe you coming on our show again on the People's Mic, too. So let's do this back and forth. And I really appreciate the opportunity to be with you now.
Well, I'd love to come back on again anytime. Just let me know.
All right. All right.
So, all right. I'll talk to you later then.
Okay, thanks.
All right. Thanks, Doug. Bye. That was Doug Cunningham with WIN, Workers Independent News, and the People's Mic. Now, we're going to take a really quick break, and up next we'll have Dawn Lindoff-Shigoni. She'll be on to talk about her, and I don't like to call them a dance group. I just don't have another way to anything else to call them, but she does have this great group that she has. It's called Call for Peace. You're listening to The Sarah Schultz Show.
Hi, I'm Eric Brandt, host of Civil Discourse, a local podcast out of Janesville, Wisconsin. You can find us on iTunes. Last Thursday, Governor Scott Walker introduced a new policy that is going to be issued and put into effect by December 16th, which is going to start charging groups of four or more people for use of the Capitol. This new policy is going to require a permit at least 72 hours in advance of their arrival, and it will charge them $50 per hour per police officer, as well as the cost of any outside security which has to be brought in. Scott Walker says that this is just aimed as a necessity for weddings and ceremonies, but how many weddings and ceremonies are only four people? Once again, this is an attack on our First Amendment rights, and Scott Walker is trying to silence the people of Wisconsin. The real problem, though, goes far beyond just what Scott Walker is doing in this particular bill. Once again, the Republican Party goes against its own mantra as they start using their power to grow government over our rights. Once again, I ask that Republican voters stop and realize that outlawing gay marriage is not small government. I ask you to realize that outlawing a woman's right to choose is not small government. I ask you to understand that taking away the right to collectively bargain and unionize is not small government. And I ask that you truly understand that charging people for their First Amendment right to protest is not small government. I'm Eric Brandt, host of Civil Discourse, and that's just something to think about.
I'd like to welcome Dawn Lindoff-Shigoni to the Sarah Schultz Show. She is the director of Call for Peace. Welcome to the show, Dawn.
Hi, Sarah.
So, since 1990, Call for Peace Drum Dance Company, a global treasure based in Madison, Wisconsin, has been inspiring national and international audiences with its performance, From All Nations They Come Dancing, The Dream of a New Hope for Humanity. Having performed at the 4th Global Summit for the Nobel Peace Prize laureates in Rome, Italy, throughout the United States, in Germany, Russia, Israel, and at the Great Pyramids of Egypt, Call for Peace is a must-see spectacular for all ages. Through the universal language of dance, traditional drums, and contemporary music, Call for Peace weaves the pageantry of life, the power of hope, and the wisdom of our elders into a tapestry of rhythm, color, and dance. Now, how did all this get started?
Well, you know, it was basically kind of a, this was back in 1989 or so, right when, you know, things were happening in northern Wisconsin in terms of treaty rights and fishing rights. So now we're, you know, in a time again in our state where some of the issues, you know, are somewhat similar, where, you know, people are divided and people are angry, and it's pretty hard to find peace when we don't really have, you know, you can't really have peace without justice. And when that was happening in 1989, I had at that right before that, maybe in 2 or 3 months before, had gone up to northern Wisconsin to the Red Cliff Reservation, and I had kind of a premonition that drums of all different cultures would come together, and I felt that the Native American drum was going to be sort of this bass drum to the drum rhythms of the world. And I talked to an elder there in the museum up there and said that I thought, you know, that these drums of different cultures would come together and that the Native drum would be that bass sort of heartbeat to our Mother Earth sound. And he, you know, the elder said, you know, that's a really good concept, and you know, don't forget that. And so probably 6 months later, the Martin Luther King Coalition in Madison, Wisconsin, actually had the idea then to bring these drum rhythms together, and they were looking for a Native American drum, and they contacted me because my husband is a Native American named Art Shigoni, and so we came together with these drums of all different cultures at the UW Great Hall to see if those rhythms would all work in harmony together. And so our performance is, you know, we're made up of 7 or 8 cultures, directors. I bring together directors of cultural national dance companies of about 8 different cultural companies. And we come together to make this Call for Peace drum and dance company. And we each share our individual culture and dance in a performance, but then we come together with all the drums and all the dancers into a circle dance where the rhythms of the world come together in harmony. And it really gives you the sort of visually and the spirit of the drum through the drums that we really are all interconnected. When we first did this performance back in 1990, through the years we've done many, you know, historical kinds of performances, but we did the Wisconsin Teachers Convention 1 year also, and teachers' response to the Call for Peace was that when you see this performance and hear it, you really see that we really have nothing to fear from one another in terms of peoples in the world. And the fact is that when we do a presentation, sometimes we do presentations in schools and we do programs also that focus on peace and respect. A lot of times what we will say is that if you were wherever you are right now, you know, sitting in your office or sitting here in this school, and you can just pretend that it's 1,000 years ago, and you could hear in 7 or 8 directions on this planet Earth, that you could hear each drum rhythm coming, the ancient drums from those different cultures of the world. But you could hear all of those drum rhythms in harmony. They would be in harmony if you could hear them all at the same time. So it kind of reveals that we have that potential or that hope that really in spirit we can hopefully find common ground and a peace with ourselves and with each other.
Okay, I'm going to put you on hold for a second while we go to a break, and we will be right back. I am speaking with Dawn Lindoff Shigoni, and you are listening to the Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz.
Thank you.
And we're back to the Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz. I'm speaking with Don Lindoff-Shigoni, Director of Call for Peace. Now, there is a spiritual element to in all of this and what you do. How does the dancing and drums bring that out?
Well, really, you know, in terms of when we're talking about even at the Capitol and that the people's mic and the fact that we had it was set up there for people and their voices to be heard for anyone who wanted to express what they were thinking and feeling. I think, you know, one of the things that happens in the Call for Peace and with the drums is that these drums, these ancient drums, were kind of the first instrument in different cultures of the world, in cultures, period, of the world, where the drum was kind of sometimes the first instrument made. And the drum was actually then became sort of the instrument that gathered or called the people to come together in community. And I think what happens is that the drums are really about the spirit of the voices of cultures of the world. When you see and hear the performance, I think it's a sound that you know once you've seen it one time and heard it, it's a sound that you don't forget. I think it's kind of interesting though that it turns out that the you know, just like in with drums, when a drummer is playing many drums, he really has that bass drum that is sort of the bass to all the other rhythms that drummer is playing. And when we do the circle dance and we come together in this metaphor that shows that we're really all interconnected to the drums and dance, it really reveals that that spirit of it reveals itself that in spirit we really are unified, and even though we don't have to talk about you know the spiritual aspect of it, it just is there when you see and hear this particular performance. And we're asked to do, you know, through the years we've been asked to do quite a few historical, that we come together basically for major historical kinds of things. We did do the opening for Monona Terrace and the opening for the Overture Center. We've done performances for Arun Gandhi, Gandhi's grandson. He's been a strong supporter of Call for Peace. We did an event at the University of Wisconsin for Earth Day where Arun Gandhi, which is the grandson of Mahatma Gandhi, and Martin Luther King's son, and Charlotte Black Elk from the Pine Ridge Reservation came and spoke at Earth Day. And so we did an event where the first time the son and grandson of Martin Luther King and Gandhi came together. The very first performance that we did do, it was done at the Madison Civic Center, and it was a Reverend Charles Garl, who was kind of the Martin Luther King of Madison, just highly respected by many people in this city. And it was his thinking to bring these drum rhythms together through the Martin Luther King Coalition. So the very first performance we did was actually at the Madison Civic Center for the Martin Luther King Coalition. And so it that's really where our beginnings came from, what came, you know, began, and it's so fitting because of the life of Martin Luther King, of course, was focused on all children, all of children of the world coming together. I mean, that was King's dream.
Well, you traveled all over the world. What are some of the highlights? Some of the most favorite places you've been to?
Well, I think one of the profound things we did, places we went, was Russia. Because, of course, when, you know, I was a young girl, it was the time when, And in high school, you know, we always thought the Russians were going to come and bomb us. You know, we were kind of, and I remember seeing when things opened up a little bit on the Donahue show. Donahue did a show where he was in Russia or connected to Russia and was talking to Russian people, and how he said, and how the Russian people said that they thought all along that they thought we were going to come and bomb them. So when we went to Russia, we were invited by the Russian Ministry of Culture because we represented, they were interested in us because we were an expression of, you know, the diversity of what makes up our country. And they wanted that expression of what the, you know, our country has many cultures. And so when we were in these concert halls, we went into six cities along the Volga River. The people would, if they couldn't get in, they were actually crying outside because they wanted to get in to see our call for peace. And the Russian people, you know, have suffered so much through war and lost many of their loved ones. So the idea of you know, seeing and hearing these cultures in the world coming together. And we would also, and when we went to each country, we would involve a representation of their drum and dance in our performance. So actually, we had some Russian dancers that actually participated and stepped into our performance. And at the end, they were part of our circle dance also. And so It was just very moving to the Russian people. For the Russian people, the arts is like their spiritual food, and when we were in these concert halls, you know, I just could hardly believe that we were there in these concert halls, having, you know, growing up with that experience of, you know, being told how, you know, it really goes to show that politics and what, you know, the politics all over the world in terms of what's happening in violence all over the world has to do with, you know, the leaders and the political leaders. The people aren't, you know, when it gets to the people, they don't really want to be killing one another. And I don't know if that day ever comes where we stop killing one another.
Well, what's your most memorable moment while doing these dances? Is it the Russian trip? Is there? I know you mentioned the other one with Gandhi's grandson and King's son. Are those it, or is there something else that had occurred that you would think, gosh, I can't forget this?
Well, the two others were certainly we were in Egypt at the Millennium Time. We were in Cairo, you know, the pyramids are there in Cairo. And, I thought, there's like 17 million people in Cairo. And when you cross the street in Cairo, you don't cross the street like you do here, maybe with 10 people crossing the street. You're crossing the street with about 200 people. You know, it was an incredible experience to be there. And of course, when those protests happened in Cairo in Egypt, you know, when basically they were peaceful protests, you know, we were really very safe when we were in Cairo. A group of us women could be out at 11 o'clock at night in the street, and you could walk New York City in the streets at 11 o'clock at night. It was a very safe feeling environment in terms of being with so many people all at the same time. So it was kind of a spiritual experience in a way to to just be with so many people in the movement of life and in a daily in the moment experience and practically doing everything with as you go through your day with so many people and of course going into the pyramids was a whole, you know, the fact that we did the call for peace there right in front of the pyramids at the millennium time was very memorable. And the other one, of course, was the Nobel Summit in Rome. And also, I guess the other thing that I just thought, we did the 100-year Parliament of the World's Religions in 1993 in Chicago. And in 1893, they had a parliament during the Columbian Exposition. And, of course, Native people were being removed from the Illinois area at that time, especially the Potawatomis. My husband is Potawatomi and Menominee. And they made sure in 1993 that they had Native American representation, and we were part of the planning of that for a full year in the 1993 Parliament of the World's Religions, of which we performed at the end of that parliament, which was 7,000 people from all over the world, 7 days long. And we closed that event, Call for Peace did, with following the Dalai Lama in Grant Park with about 70,000 people. And as we did the circle dance in the Grant Park there on the stage, it was like these people, 70,000 people, started to gather in groups of circles and started to dance. And that was quite a great experience to have that all happen, seeing people from all over the world with different types of spiritual beliefs and all coming together. It was just, I guess that was a moment not to really forget.
Well, if people want more information, where can they go?
Our site is callforpeace.org. So everything is there. I also would like to say we're based in Madison, and we've been part of a center. Our location for Call for Peace has been in a center that is an arts and education center in a low-income neighborhood, which is basically Southeast Asian, excuse me, and the center has been focused on arts education, and so this Bayview International Center for Arts Education is where we've been located because we've put a strong emphasis in this neighborhood of 102 townhouses for low-income families. Which is a real multi-ethnic neighborhood. We've put a strong focus on the children in this neighborhood learning about each other's culture. And my director that works here at the center, we've often said, boy, you know, when we were growing up as a young kid, this would have been a pretty neat place to grow up in this neighborhood. So this particular neighborhood of Bayview is a neighborhood that actually is the oldest neighborhood in Madison, which is only about 8 blocks down from the state capitol. And people from this Greenbush neighborhood actually were very responsible, and the Italian people that were also in this neighborhood in terms of building the Wisconsin state capitol. So I just wanted to let you know that, to let everyone know that.
Thanks, Don. And the website again is Call for Peace, callforpeace.org.
Yep, that's
okay.
It.
Okay. And now
thanks,
you know
Sarah,
what to visit.
So much.
So, oh, you're welcome. Thanks for being on, and thank you for doing what you're doing, and keep up the, you know, traveling, and keep up doing what you're doing, and it's so needed right now, especially. So thank you so much for being on, Don.
Sure. Thanks a lot.
That was Dawn Lindoff Shigoni, and she is director of the Call for Peace.
Now we're dashing through the snow. in a one-horse open sleigh. O'er the fields we go, laughing on the way. Bells on bobtails ring, making spirits bright. What fun it is to ride and sing a sleighing song tonight. Oh, jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way.
Here's a recorded interview I did with Kate Coyne McCoy on the CAPS program.
I'd like to welcome Kate Coyne McCoy to the Sarah Schultz Show. Kate is the Executive Director of CAPS, which is the Coalition for Accountability in Political Spending. Now, I know in the last couple shows we've gone over some of the ways to bring money into the community, and we are entering the last part of the holiday shopping season. And this is just one more way that we can use money to support our stances politically. So, Kate, before I get into what CAPS is, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I am a social worker, actually, by trade and education, but I came to CAPS 4 months ago to help build this national bipartisan coalition of public officials that are devoted to really curbing the role of corporations in elections. I live in Rhode Island, but work all over the country trying to recruit Democrat and Republican leaders to be part of our effort.
Right, and you just touched on CAPS, but who is CAPS again?
CAPS is really the nation's first and only bipartisan coalition of public officials. And so right now, all of our members are elected officials with a fiduciary role or in their state or city's pension system or in their state or city's procurement system. So, for example, the founder of CAPS, Bill de Blasio, is the public advocate of the city of New York, and that elected position gives him a fiduciary role on the New York City Pension Fund. Our members include Governor Quinn of Illinois and North Carolina State Treasurer Janet Cowell, the Comptroller of New York State, Tom DiNapoli, the State Treasurer of Pennsylvania, Rob McCord, the Comptroller of Los Angeles, Wendy Gruhl, and three legislators, one in North Carolina, Bill Current, one in New Hampshire, James Tilliott, and a Hillsborough County Commissioner named Tony Pappas.
Well, how did this get started? What brought CAPS about?
CAPS is really a response to a Supreme Court decision called Citizens United, which I'm sure your listeners are familiar with, given what's been going on in Wisconsin this year. It was started by Bill de Blasio, who recognized right away that, you know, unlimited, undisclosed, secret spending by corporations into our political system is pollution and corrupting and needs to be heavily regulated or stopped completely and disclosed to shareholders and consumers. So CAPS is an effort to inform communities and inform consumers and to change corporate behavior by engaging with corporations. We have a whole legislative arm of our work, but we're really working to get corporate money out of politics.
How long has CAPS actually been around, and how did you get everyone to kind of come together on this?
Right. It was started in January of 2010, right after the decision came down of Citizens United. And, you know, Bill de Blasio immediately recognized the need and started recruiting members, people he knew and his friends in the elected world. And then I came on in August and helping to build it and expand it and diversify it. So we bring our members on by asking, by pointing out to elected officials that it's important to engage in this work and by asking them to join us.
Well, you came out with a holiday shopping guide. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Our holiday shopping guide is available at www.politicalspending.org, and it's there that you can find not only the guide but all kinds of information about CAPS. And what we did was put together a list of places we think you should shop and places we think you might want to give a second thought to. With the 2012 presidential elections sort of looming, we know that super PACs and PACs and corporations are going to devote millions of dollars to corporate dollars to influence voters. And so we think as you shop, you should think about how your money might help corporations influence politics and make sure that the dollars you spend are in line with your own values and your own politics. So we used two indexes that rank corporate disclosure, one called the Baruch Index and another done by a guy named Bruce Fried, who's been involved in this work forever, called the CPA Zicklin Index. And what those two indexes did was evaluate the disclosure, the transparency of political spending in corporations. So, for example, we found that U.S. Bank Corp., the financial services parent of U.S. Bank, got a top-tier score. They make all of their political spending transparent and publicly available on their website. MasterCard, one of the most recognized brands in the world, tells us very little about their company's political spending. And so as you're using a credit card, you might want to consider using a U.S. Bank Corp card instead of a MasterCard. When you look at places where you might shop, you know, Walmart, the largest private employer in the retail world, spent at least $6 million on lobbying in 2010. And yet receive the lowest possible score when it comes to political accountability and transparency. For lots of reasons, people refrain from going into Walmart, but this is, you know, another reason that they might consider. Other corporations and businesses that scored very poorly on the guide were Amazon.com, the world's largest online retailer, but they got a zero on the CPA index. They don't disclose anything, but they are definitely no stranger to political spending. CVS, you might go into CVS and still do your stocking stuffers. They have 7,000 stores in 41 states, but their information about corporate political activity is very hidden and very hard to find. And they admit that they seek to be an effective participant in the political process. We think their shareholders and their consumers should know where they're spending their political money, and they go to great effort to hide it. The guide is a list of good guys and bad guys in the corporate world, and provides you with good consumer information about where you might do your holiday shopping.
I'm going to go back. You had mentioned they got a 0 out of 100. Now, that means that there's no political, they're not disclosing anything, and 100 means that they're disclosing everything, and they just fall into that range. Is that what you're speaking of when you use those numbers?
Yes, and it's also, you know, ranked about on how easy it is to find the information. So if you bring up Walmart's website on your computer, can you find what level of ease can you find how they spent their money, or what kinds of policy they have about spending it? Can one CEO just write a check without telling anybody to a candidate? Or is there a process? Does the board have to know? Is the board involved in the decision? How often does the board review the political spending? How are consumers and shareholders informed about the political spending that's made? And that's just about direct contributions. I mean, the bigger problem really that comes out of Citizens United, Sarah, is the secret spending. So, for example, Walmart could say, well, we're not spending any money on direct politics, but what they might do is make a big contribution to the Chamber of Commerce, which in turn will spend the money in politics, but does not have to disclose that it is using Walmart money. I mean, the most egregious example of this is we saw in the healthcare debate in 2009, So by day, members of Cigna and WellPoint and Aetna and Humana, all very big health insurers, were in the White House supporting Barack Obama's effort to pass health care reform with their organization that they all belong to, the Association of Health Insurance Plans. But by night, when we turned on our televisions, we would see ads slamming health care reform, and those ads were produced by the Chamber of Commerce. That money was funneled to the Chamber of Commerce in an undisclosed way by health insurance companies. It's just like Pablo Escobarian money laundering, if you will. I don't have to tell you where it goes. I can write a check to the chamber or to a third party, and that third party can spend it on my behalf.
Well, when they write the check, they know exactly what's going to be done with it.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, wink, wink, nod, nod, right?
Exactly. And this index then follows that spending as well, and they rank it as well with that. So it's not only what they're outwardly doing, but the PACs and the other groups that they're secretly sending the money to?
You know, the index, I would encourage your listeners to Google Baruch Index, B-A-R-U-C-H, and the CPA Index. If you go to Google and put either one of those in, they pop right up. There's also an IRCC index, which is really great. That's an examination of the 500 S&P. The other two, just take a look at the S&P 100. But there's all kinds of information on those indexes about corporate spending. You could go to OpenSecrets.com or the SunlightFoundation.org and get incredible amounts of information about corporate spending. What you can't get is information about secret spending, which after Citizens United is completely legal.
So how do you get that information? You just have to pull it from each company then to see where they've actually sent the checks to?
No, actually, the only reason we have the health insurance example is because of a sourced report that a journalist got. We at CAPS are actually making some assumptions about corporate spending based on what is reported by a corporation for lobbying. So most corporations spend money to lobby the government, and you know, to the tune of $900+ million in 2010. And that money is reported. Well, I think it's pretty safe to assume that if a corporation like Walmart or Amazon or Sunoco is spending millions of dollars to lobby the government, they're probably spending millions of dollars in elections, too, to influence electioneering. And so in the absence of complete disclosure, which is, you know, what CAPS is fighting for, that corporations must disclose, we're making some assumptions based on previous behavior and based on what corporations spend to lobby the government.
So basically you're just taking what you already know is out there and saying, okay, well, since they're doing this, we're going to go out on a limb and say they're also doing this because of their habits they've done in the past.
Right. One strategy that CAPS uses is to send letters to corporations. We're in the process now of sending our second round of letters to target the corporations that we think are spending undisclosed money. And we put it right out there, and we ask them, we can't find your policy. We think you need to have one. Will you write one? If you have one that we can't find, where is it? We want you to refrain from using Treasury dollars in electioneering. And if you have to use Treasury dollars in electioneering, we want to know more about that. We want you to disclose where and when you spend, to whom you spend, every dime. We want to know where it goes. And then we use the letters as an entree to negotiation with those corporations.
To find out what they're doing?
Yeah, I mean, to say, look, tell us. And if you won't tell us, you know, that's a real indication that you think you have something to hide or that you think it is not the risky business that it is. I mean, there are two Harvard studies that clearly demonstrate that corporations that spend money in politics and in electioneering are less profitable than corporations that don't. And so if the value of a corporation is the benefit it brings to its shareholders in terms of profit, engaging in electioneering is, will have negative consequences. Look back to in Wisconsin. In the cycle before the 2010, so in 2008, you had state legislators running for election in districts where they would spend $100,000, $200,000. In 2010, what you saw in Wisconsin was the influx of money in some districts to the tune of $4 to $6 million by outside entities trying to influence elections. And so, it's almost like the candidate becomes irrelevant. The candidate doesn't know about this money. The candidate isn't coordinating with the entity spending the money. You've got the chamber fighting a Democratic candidate or outside money for a Democratic, for a Republican, the other way. Both parties are engaged in that. It's not just the Republicans. It's not just the Democrats. Both parties are guilty of
it. And we saw it even with our Supreme Court as well.
Absolutely. So absolutely.
It's not just our political. It's also any election you see this kind of money coming and pouring in.
Yeah.
It's a problem everywhere. And that's really one of the reasons that I was so excited to see the shopping guide, because now at least it gives us an idea of where we can go and where we can spend and who we can spend with and who we should avoid, so we don't see that kind of problem. Or at least make a statement, because apparently the only way that they're going to actually know something by when we hit them in the pocketbook.
Exactly. Exactly. And let me tell your listeners again where to find that guide. It's www.politicalspending.org. And we would love them to go to the website. There are all kinds of tools, letters that they can download to corporations, and just chock full of information about specific corporations and their disclosure. Their political spending and their policies. And so we really encourage your listeners to go to those websites, and download not only the guide, but also the information that's there for the taking.
So how can people keep this going and make sure they spend the money with the stores that they want to spend it with?
I think that certainly for CAPS, we will continue to put out information and consumer guides as often as we can. Check back to the website regularly. But, individual consumers have a lot of power in this fight. They can vote with their feet and vote with their dollars. They can make sure that corporations know that they won't spend their dollars in places where political spending isn't disclosed. Many of your listeners are probably shareholders in some of these corporations. Perhaps they have some of their pension funds tied up in them, or their IRAs or their investments tied up in them. They need to make sure that those money managers know, I don't want my money invested in stock that's connected to CVS or any of the other, or Walmart, Walgreens, the other corporations that are listed in the guide. Consumers can be very, very powerful. Our movement is connected, not in formal, but in informal ways, to lots of other action that's going on around the country on these issues. Certainly, the Occupy movement is bringing lots of this information to, an awareness about how the little guy is sort of being crushed by the big corporations. Occupy's done a lot of that work. They're also seeking to change the Constitution and undo what the Supreme Court decision Citizens United did. The fact is, corporations are not people. There are folks trying to change the Constitution and amend it to fix the problem. There are other folks working to get the SEC to more heavily regulate and to force companies through regulation to disclose. So there's lots of ways to get involved. If anyone wants to get involved in CAPS or in any of these organizations, all they have to do is go onto the website and send me an email.
What's that website again people can go to?
It's www.politicalspending.org.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for being on today, Kate.
Thank you very much, Sarah. It was a pleasure.
I'd like to thank Kate Coyne McCoy for coming on the Sarah Schultz Show today. She is the Executive Director of CAPS. And again, their website is www.politicalspending.org.
Okay, you're listening to the Sarah Schultz Show of Sarah Schultz. And up next will be Scott Witkoff, the blogger from Badger Democracy.
Gonna stop in California for a cocktail and some gas. By the time he gets to England, he's got no more guns left. Santa's got a hot rod.
Hey, Scott.
Good morning, Sarah.
Welcome back to the show today. Now, you have some pretty interesting breaking news coming on, don't you?
Yeah. 5 minutes before I called to come on your show, I received a voicemail from a source of mine at the Legislative Research Bureau. And for anybody that doesn't know, the Legislative Research Bureau is staffed with attorneys that write the laws and adapt them for Wisconsin statutes to be voted on. So when you look at a bill, just a little background, when you look at a bill, say like a PDF file, in the upper right-hand corner, there's a bunch of initials, and those are the initials of all the attorneys at the Legislative Reference Bureau that worked on the bill and actually wrote the legal language into the bill that the legislators who author the bill request. So as you know, in the mining hearing, it was very heated, and Mary Williams, who's the chair of the committee, refused to give the name of the author of the bill. And so the voicemail I got from somebody at the Legislative Reference Bureau told me who the author of the bill is. Or in this case, as they call it, the requester of the bill. So the interesting thing is, I wrote a blog a few days ago linking ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Council, model legislation with the mining bill, with the environmental deregulation, the way it treats groundwater, surface water, environmental impact, things like that. And this person's name was brought up in the piece, and it's Mark Honnadell from Milwaukee. He's the author of the mining bill.
And now, I was going to say, he's on the committee, the mining committee.
Right. So not only is he on the mining committee, he's a member of ALEC, okay, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which also the blog linked, of course, Koch Industries money with ALEC and these other third-party think tanks and legal foundations, such as Hamilton Consulting in Madison, which also operates the Great Lakes Legal Foundation. So there are a lot of Koch ties, even though Koch is not running this mine, they've not gone on record or registered as lobbying for this mine, but their money is deeply into the kind of the details of this bill as it involves environmental deregulation. So it's really important to remember, because Koch Industries, is potentially waiting for a bill like this to pass to someday come in and begin mining operations in Wisconsin. But more immediately, yes, Mark Honnadell, member of the mining committee, member of ALEC, also received a lot of money from Gogobic Taconite, or GTAC, the mining company, in his last campaign in 2010. He received, I don't have the number from it, I believe it was up in the neighborhood of $2,000 to $2,500. From GTAC. So
is that the maximum? Is that the maximum that they could give him?
It was four or five people, all executives from the company, who gave $500 each, which is the maximum individual contribution for an assembly race. So it's $500 for assembly, $1,000 for Senate, and then it's $43,000 and change for governor. So yes, those individuals in direct giving donated the maximum allowed by law to his campaign. So So, again, so let's follow the money. Okay, you know, GTAC, the mining company, gives money to Mark Conondale from Milwaukee, who also received money from Bucyrus. Let's remember that. Bucyrus makes, you know, big, giant mining equipment and machinery who stand to profit from this mine.
And that was just sold to Caterpillar as well. They just, didn't they just sell,
right.
Wasn't it them? Yeah.
Yep, yep. So they gave him money as well. And this legislator, who's a member of ALEC, who gets all this model environmental deregulation legislation from ALEC, which is pre-screened and passed by companies like Koch Industries, presents it in Wisconsin to completely change the face of mining and deregulate it and make the permitting process much more difficult for the DNR to regulate and much easier for companies to do whatever they want with use of surface water, groundwater, in their mining process. So in not only in following the money, but in following the legislation, this mining bill is a disaster. It is a big boondoggle, and the chairman of the jobs committee, Mary Williams, knows it, which is why she has not committed. She will not even hold a hearing in the district where the mine will be located. You know, she holds the hearing in West Allis as far away from the mine as possible. And she, you know, her district is just one district south of where the mine is. She will not even hold a hearing up there on the mine. So they know this is bad policy. They know it's bad government. And it's just one big giveaway after that. So Mark Conondale is the legislator that, if people want to voice a direct opinion to the author of the bill, he's the person to contact.
Didn't Conondale write a couple water bills as well?
I'm sure he did. I honestly don't have that in front of me right now. He may have written a couple bills that may still be in committee. You know, and of course, prior to a bill being introduced in committee, you know, we really don't have access to it unless the legislator releases it as an LRB document. So it's hard to say. It's certainly something to consider looking at. But just in and of itself, I know you've looked at the bill. The way it deals with surface water is a crime. You know, the DNR could not regulate the use of surface water for the mine if the mining company says we need it for mining operations. So, you know, what authority? It completely takes any authority away from the state or the DNR to regulate these operations and how they utilize groundwater and surface water.
And it can't. I would say you can't sue them. They've got it in there where you can't sue the mining company. They've got it in there where they don't have to release any information to anybody, and the DNR doesn't even need to release, doesn't even get that information if they don't want to, and the DNR doesn't have to. I mean, it's just, I like to put little nicknames on bills, and the only thing I can come up with is a piece of crap. So this is bill is the piece of crap mining bill.
It is. And, I don't know if you've discussed the 360-day time limit the DNR has to complete their environmental impact and issue an opinion on a permit. And this is really critical, is that in the bill, the DNR would only have 360 days to act on a permit, either to deny it or approve it. And understand the circumstances for denying are very specific, and they have to meet a lot of requirements to deny a permit. If they do not act within 360 days, the permit is automatically approved. Now, you've had testimony has been sent from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, a completely nonpartisan group who has said it takes them 2 to 4 years to research a mining, to complete a mining study. 2 years minimum to do a mining study. And in this bill, it would be 300. So what kind of a mining study are you going to be able to do in 360 days if the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers says it takes minimum 2 years?
Well, and then do they still have the provision in there that says that the DNR has to respond within 360 days? And if they don't, then the permit automatically approved. So basically about the day that they get whatever information they're going to get from the study, they have one day or 12 hours or 6 hours or 2 hours to look it over and approve or deny the permit.
Well, they have, let's see. So they, from the time they get the completed application, they have that 360-day, the clock starts ticking. So it's less than a year. And regarding the permit, you know, I have this all linked in my blog. Once they get the permit, they can't question the quality of information submitted on that document. So they can't question the scientific data or the scientific methods used in the company's research that they are putting in their permit application. And the law also gets rid of the contested case language, whereas now it's mandatory to hold a contested case hearing, which means the DNR holds a hearing under administrative rule where witnesses for and against give testimony under oath, and they can be cross-examined so that you can get down to the nitty-gritty of the scientific data and information used in the study. That this new mining bill completely takes out that contested case hearing. So there's no contested case, no witnesses, no under oath testimony. So yes, you're right. It is literally a piece of crap. And I guarantee you, as we dig deeper and deeper and deeper into the authoring of this bill, now that we know who the author is, and I can assure you, I, among I'm sure other people now, will start doing open records requests to Representative Honadel to request records pertaining to GTAC and Cyrus and their lobbyists and things like that to find out what the process of this bill authoring was. We will find out that it was in essence authored by these groups, by this company, and there's nothing good for Wisconsin in this bill. Absolutely nothing. There's no guarantee of jobs. There's no guarantee of tax revenue because of the way the tax laws are structured now.
Yeah, I was going to say they've already made that certain within, 2 to 10 years.
Exactly.
These guys aren't paying any taxes. 2 to 10 years.
Exactly. And the bigger the company, the less taxes they will be liable for under the new, legislation. So, there's nothing good for Wisconsin in this bill. And the response at the hearing on Wednesday shows it. And I would be shocked if Representative Williams holds a hearing in northern Wisconsin, either in her district or up in Ashland and Iron County. I would be shocked if she holds, because anybody involved in the tourism industry up there, involved with natural resources up there, this bill is a nightmare for that type, not to mention what it would do to the Native American population that lives up there. So, yeah, the bill's a disaster.
You know, I've always said, as these bills came out, this mining bill and the last mining bill, I've always said that if it was, instead of a reservation, high-end white homes up there, there were $200,000, $300,000 homes apiece, I guarantee you we would not be talking about a mining bill right now. I guarantee you this mine would not even be in discussion if that, instead of a reservation, those were white $300,000 homes.
Yeah, if Kohler Company had a resort and a golf course up there, you wouldn't be talking about a mine up there. You'd be talking about a lot of minimum wage jobs up there is what you'd be talking about. So, exactly.
So, who was it, Honadel, who also wrote the last mining bill? Because it doesn't seem like anything really changed from the one that they leaked earlier to this one.
Right. It's substantively the same bill. Here's the interesting thing that, it's pretty much the same bill that was leaked. The original bill that was leaked was something like 188 pages. This one's 183 pages. So it's virtually the same bill. And, you know, all directions pointed to Honeywell, because he was the person in, I think it was in May, he came out and said that he was working on a mining bill. So, you know, it's the same thing. The interesting thing is how, obviously, the Fitzgeralds, being in party leadership, have pushed this bill to the forefront, put it on a fast track. But, of course, GTAC gave thousands of dollars to both the Fitzgerald brothers as well. And, you know, you have Mary Williams as a willing accomplice, being the only Republican within kind of a stone's throw of the mine, where the district where the mine is. You know, the district where the mine is represented by a Democratic assembly person and Senator Jouk. And assembly person Williams is one district south of the mine. So you have a willing accomplice there. And she's taken money from, various interests like Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, who Robert Fassbender just happens to also be a lobbyist attorney for Hamilton Consulting, and that, you know, that chain is all in the blog as well, you know, with the lobbyists for Hamilton, and Robert Fassbender is a registered lobbyist for Koch Industries as well. So it's just amazing. And, you know, if I can just digress for a minute, we're seeing, some very desperate measures playing out here, with all the court action in Waukesha County by the Republicans, you know, regarding the recall and attempting to, Senator Fitzgerald, introducing legislation that would dissolve the GAB. Representative Fitzgerald. So there's a lot of desperate measures here. So the recalls are of utmost importance right now.
It's too bad that we couldn't recall Representative Fitzgerald like they are doing to his brother.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I agree. But here's something, and I was talking to somebody about this a couple days ago. It's involved with United Wisconsin. The more signatures, it's great that they released the number, 500,000 and change. But the more signatures we can get, if we can get 1 million signatures, think of the message that sends to every elected representative. And not that we're going to hold them hostage, but, or do something extreme with recalls every time we don't get the Democrats don't get their way. That's not what I'm saying. But I'm saying, as far as, coming to the table, listening to the opposition, working together and doing what's right for Wisconsin, because all these power grabs that are going on right now to dissolve the GAB, a completely nonpartisan board that, let's be honest here, Democrats have not liked every decision the GAB has made in the last year. And you don't see Mark Pocan and, Senator Miller introducing legislation to dissolve the GAB. The GAB is one of the most highly regarded institutions of its kind in the entire country. And when you see a power grab that would go back to a partisan ethics board like we had, that gave you things like, what Scott Jensen and Chuck Koala did, with the caucus scandals, and stood by and, was not on top of something like that. That's the kind of power grab that we need to send a strong message that, we will not tolerate that. And that's the importance of the recalls.
We've got about a minute left before I've got to get going, but is there any evidence of the Fitzgerald brothers' hands on this bill at all, or is it just the fact that they're connected to Alec just kind of puts them in there?
Well, they both got money from GTAC, from the mining company, upwards of $1,000 in both of their recent campaigns. and understand that as the majority leaders in both the Assembly and Senate, it is their prerogative to push bills, you know, into committee to expedite bills, to put them on the fast track. And it is very obvious when you look at the money, and again, the link is in my blog, to the GAB website where these amounts are disclosed, that these key figures like the two Fitzgeralds and Mark Honeywell got significant amounts of money from the mining company and have obviously been paid well for their services. Fitzgerald in expediting the process, pushing the legislation into committee and eventually through both houses, and then obviously Honeywell for his authorship and sponsorship of the bill. So, you know, the money prints are all over those guys. So.
And what's your website again for your blog for people to read this?
If somebody wants to they can Google or do a search, Badger Democracy, or it's www.bdgrdemocracy.wordpress.com. So a lot easier to just Google Badger Democracy. And the blog is linking the Koch and Alec money to the mining bill.
Thank you so much for being on today, Scott. We'll get you back on in the new year to talk more about it, because I'm sure there'll be a ton of breaking news in the next 2 weeks. So.
Thank you, and it's always a pleasure, and have a great holiday.
Thank you. You too.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, bye. That was Scott Witkoff, the blogger from Badger Democracy. And again, his website is bdgrdemocracy.wordpress.com or Google Badger Democracy. Now, I'd like to thank you for listening to the Sarah Schultz Show today. I'd like to thank my producer, Bill, for all his hard work on the show this week. You can download the show from iTunes, or you can listen to the archive shows at www.blogtalkradio.com/Sarah Schultz or at the website at www.sarahschultzshow.com. You can also listen to the Sarah Schultz Show off the new Sarah Schultz Show app for Android phones. Yay! I'm excited it's on. It's a free download to go and get that. You also tune in on Saturday at 6 p.m. to Citywide 99.1 FM in Madison. Have a great holiday, everyone, and I will see you in the new year.